all that matters is...
Wrong!
This town deserves a better class.
Heavy Metal Podcast.
And I'm gonna give it...
If you do not listen, then the hell with you.
Walk through the gate of consciousness. Stop from drop from under you.
What you are hearing is the sound of five young men taking the stage of the Majestic Theater at the Brooklyn Academy of Music on the evening of April 10th, 1996. That night, they were playing a live acoustic set to be recorded and broadcast 3 months later on MTV. For the four permanent band members, it would be their first concert together in over 2.5 years. And for the final member to take the stage that night, he's about to go on right now. It would be one of his last. But the performance that you are listening to now is the end of our story. And it is the prelude to another. For this series, I'm going to tell you the first and then a little bit about the second. But in order to return to that evening in summer of 1996, I have to go back in time to tell you about a different band in 1987. But before I do that, I ought to say, welcome to And Volume For All, a deeply reverent and lovingly irreverent exploration of the history, philosophy, and future of the greatest music in the world, heavy metal. I am your brave little hoster, Quinn. And today, we are going to be talking about not only one of my favorite bands of all time, but I think one of the most unlikely success stories and unrecognized influences in all of heavy metal history, Alice in Chains. I have to say, I was somewhat surprised when I started talking about doing this series by the relative lack of surprise. I've always suspected that Alice in Chains was considered a properly heavy band by the majority of my fellow metal connoisseurs. But in the Aristotelian tradition of categorizing the ever-loving crap out of everything that was once enjoyable, Alice in Chains is more popularly known as a grunge band. Now, for those of you unfamiliar with grunge, hello, welcome to our world. We call this planet Earth. My species is but one of many here, but through biological advantages, we humans have become the dominant culture among all living organisms. Do not be afraid. We are a peaceful people.
Shut up. Shut up. I think they're buying it.
Grunge was one of the most popular mutations to come out of late 20th century rock and roll, and was born, as was I, in the Pacific Northwest corner of the United States, predominantly the city of Seattle, Washington.
Evergreen and ever-growing, always reaching out and going to limits far beyond our knowing. Washington's for me.
A little bit of Washington State propaganda that I was required to sing in fifth grade, and which I have never forgotten because my brain is a dumpster for every commercial jingle and TV theme song that I ever heard in my entire life. Sure, it's an abject, never-ending hell, forever raging within my skull, but it's also pretty catchy in there. Yes, Seattle was the proverbial eye of the shitstorm, but there were also offerings from more modest towns all across the state, including Aberdeen, Olympia, Ellensburg, and other places that you should never visit. And the reason I was surprised by the lack of surprise is because a lot of people seem to think of grunge as having arrived fully formed, like Athena bursting from John Hurt's chest. However, as is true of all artistic innovations, grunge was both a reaction to the music and culture that immediately preceded it, as well as a synthesis, take a shot, of some of that music's pre-existing elements. The two major genres that are most often cited as essential to the creation of this new form of music are punk and, of course, heavy metal, which is why we're here. In fact, Sub Pop, the record label responsible for many of the bands that have come to typify grunge in the public imagination, including Nirvana and Soundgarden, marketed their novel sound as a hybrid between metal and punk. Vocalist for the proto-grunge band Green River, which would eventually be known as Mudhoney, Mark Arm is often cited as the first to coin the term in reference to an early band, Mr. Epp, calling their second EP Pure Grunge, Pure Noise, in the music fanzine Desperate Times in 1981. And yes, Doomy, 1981. I read that number correctly. This time. Shut up, leave me alone. Do your own podcast. Please don't leave me. I know we don't tend to think of grunge as existing that early on the timeline, but most musical movements get their start before the moment that we all think of as their inception, like metal in the late 60s or hip-hop in the late 70s. Sub Pop was founded in 1986 and then began pushing the grunge label in its official marketing, including a 1987 company catalog describing the genre as gritty vocals, roaring Marshall amps, and ultra-loose, all caps, grunge that destroyed the morals of a generation. Wait, grunge does that? Damn it! I thought it was video games. I wasted years playing Bubble Bobble. Hey, remember Bubble Bobble? Anyway, in a 1996 documentary called Hype, a guitarist with the awesome name of Leighton Beezer, from a band with an even better one of The Throne Ups, argues that Green River took the chord progression from the Ramones' Rockaway Beach and turned it into grunge with the song Come On Down. So here's a little compare-contrast I put together of those songs. Take a listen.
1, 2, 3, 4!
I really enjoyed fiddling around on the song medleys that I made for World War I series, and I won't be able to do that as much on this one, so thought I'd get it in while I can. Hey, you can take the boy out of the fiddling, but you can't take the fiddling out of the... Oh, no, no, nope, nope, no. Abort, abort that one. Let's just slowly back away from that construction and never speak of this again. So I would say that the punk part of the influence equation gets the heroine's share of credit for the many musical contributions that were made to grunge. I've even seen folks on Metal Twitter arguing that grunge doesn't have any relationship to heavy metal, and yet nobody made that point at all when I teased doing a series on Alice in Chains. I don't know, maybe they don't follow me, or maybe they all died. Maybe they all died because they don't follow me. Something to think about. But one of the arguments I want to make right at the top of this series is that I believe grunge was not just influenced by metal, but ought to be rightly categorized as its own subgenre of heavy metal. And evidence A in that argument is the band that we are covering today. So I want to get into Alice in Chains here, but I also want to lay out some ideas about the compositional nature of grunge and the historical background that led to the creation of this band's singular sound. Philosophically, grunge blends the spectrum of socially conscious to downright nihilistic attitudes of punk with the pure poetic outrage of heavy metal. Whereas musically, the new sound from Seattle adopted the simplicity of punk, but filtered it through the down-tuned distortion and spine-shattering volume of who else but the greatest band to ever set foot on this deeply unworthy planet, the Black Sabbath. I just recently listened to an interview with Jerry Cantrell of Alice in Chains on what I imagine is an otherwise terrible podcast called Let There Be Talk. Do you guys listen to this? Obviously, I listened for Cantrell, but the host is this guy named Dean Del Rey, and he's just everything I can't stand about metalheads and, like, people. He kept talking to Jerry Cantrell about great songs by Alice in Chains, but not the albums that they came from, and he insisted on referring to them as tunes. Rooster, man, that's a great tune. Rooster is not a tune. It's My Party and I'll Cry If I Want To is a tune. And everything was either mind-blowing or killer. And then somewhere he must have learned the word haunting, because I think he described like 15 different songs by completely different artists that way. Mr. Brownstone, man, such a haunting tune. Like, are you not aware of your character proximity to Bart Simpson's bus driver, Otto? The dude actually asked Jerry Cantrell, I swear to God, this is verbatim.
You remember The Unplugged?
You remember The Unplugged? No, he fucking forgot the night he recorded a live acoustic set of his greatest hits, and then they broadcast it to the world, basically the final live recording of one of his best friends and the greatest frontman in all of rock music. It just slipped his mind. But the entire reason I brought it up is that in the interview, the guy says, and I'm not making this up, this is not a bit, you can listen to it, episode 272. He says,
so I was going through the tunes, and other than Iommi, you're like our best riff guy.
And that is a good point. It's just phrased in a way that makes it sound deliberately stupid. But then, well-known riff guy Jerry Cantrell said of Tony Iommi, he's probably my biggest influence. I kind of got the want to create the riff like that. Just a good, steady groove and a memorable, simple riff. That's what always got me. So I kind of tried to emulate that in my own way. Do you hear how he talks, Dean? How he uses words like steady and simple that actually describe the thing he's talking about instead of just his subjective experience of it, like mind-blowing. Can you try that on your podcast where you talk about music? Could be a good skill to learn. Sorry, I'm probably just jealous that Dean Del Rey gets to talk to one of the most influential and prolific riff guys in all of metal. But back to my point. I also read an article by a guy named Max Turner from VH1 who argued that grunge had a much broader set of influences that were filtered down into individual bands, making grunge the most heterogeneous of all modern musical movements. Guess he's never heard of mumblecore, huh? Mumblecore. Turner said this, for better or worse, these bands were all lumped together, even though each one had its own unique style, sound, and influences. Nirvana was influenced by punk, Pearl Jam took cues from classic rock, and then there were the metal guys, the sludgy, dark, heavy bands, like Soundgarden, Alice in Chains, and Tad. Tad? Who the fuck is Tad? I guess I'll find out in their episode of Let There Be Talk.
You guys are like our best Tad guys. The tunes, they're so haunting and killer.
Turner continued, these bands were a different beast, using hard rock and heavy metal as the basis for a more sinister sound. And I mostly agree here, but there is one influence that is less frequently cited when discussing grunge that I think is what he's missing. Pearl Jam does have a classic rock vibe to their early records, but I think they exemplify another feature of grunge in the form of its acoustic and first-person storytelling elements. To my ear, this aspect of the genre, or subgenre as the case may be, comes from the inclusion of folk. Pearl Jam's Daughter and Alive. Creep by STP. Nirvana has Dumb and All Apologies off of In Utero. All of which feel heavily influenced by the acoustic narratives of guys like this.
Better to burn out than to fade away. They give you this, but you pay for that. And once you're gone, you can't ever come back. When you're out of the blue and into the black.
So that's Hey Hey My My, Out of the Blue, by Neil Young, who I hear everywhere in grunge, even on The Unplugged from Alice in Chains. But don't mention it to Jerry Cantrell. He just does not remember. And while folk seems to be the one genre that Black Sabbath never even tried to turn into metal, thank Iommi, I don't think the inclusion of folk elements is mutually exclusive with the categorization of grunge as a metal subgenre. The genius of Black Sabbath, or at least one of them, was in translating the blues and jazz into metal. And in a similar way, I think the genius of Alice in Chains, or at least one of them, could be that they found a way to turn the sound of folk into metal. Here's a demo version of a track that would end up on their second studio album, Dirt. Now, that is not an acoustic guitar that Jerry Cantrell is playing at the opening of this song, but it's sure close. I think it's intended to sound acoustic because if it weren't for Cantrell playing literally every song on the same guitar since 1985, it might very well have been. And I went with a demo version because the EP that that song was originally written for, called Sap, which we will cover, was almost entirely acoustic, or at least acoustic adjacent, because of Cantrell's devotion to the Rampage G&L he called Blue Dress. Although some argue it was gold. Yeah, second time for that joke. I'm gonna hang its jersey in the rafters after this season. Jerry Cantrell also said that the album version of the song lost something that the demo captured perfectly, so I thought you should hear it. Also, it's a great example of what I mean by turning folk into metal. The track begins like a really dark folk song, sort of like Hey Hey My My. And then, when it hits the chorus, it just explodes into full-blown metal. And now I got Rooster out of the way, which is good, because I don't really love that song. Leave me alone, Doomy. We're different people. I don't have to just adopt your personality for us to be friends. Stop bothering me while I'm working. Please return my calls. If we want to rigidly categorize metal as distinct from other genres, even genres as vastly different to heavy metal as folk, we aren't left with a whole lot. Metal has continued to grow and evolve and expand since its inception in 1970, and one of those adaptations was the inclusion of folk by the way of grunge. For as sort of doctrinaire as we metal nerds can be, I think we do ourselves a disservice to imagine that the strength of the genre doesn't come, at least in part, from its ability to enfold other musical traditions into its own, resulting in something that fucks in new and exciting ways. That grunge opened the door for folk music to become, from time to time, super fucking brutal, doesn't mean that grunge is any less metal than other subgenres. In fact, I think it's one of the strongest arguments for its inclusion. Pearl Jam is the one major grunge band that probably betrays the least amount of heavy DNA in their sound. But Nirvana? Alice in Chains? Soundgarden? STP? Even Smashing Pumpkins? Bullet with Butterfly Wings and Zero? Those are full-on metal songs. I also feel that Alice in Chains' uniquely metal boner fetus don't just come from the bands and the sounds that influenced them, but also those bands that they have in turn influenced. Like many of you, I listen to a ton of new metal, and the inspirations in that music that I think I hear most clearly and most often come from Alice in Chains and Mastodon, which might also say something about the kind of bands that I listen to or what it is that I'm listening for. But I don't want to venture too far into that point yet, because I'll come back to it once we start digging into their catalog. I just wanted to put that idea in your head before we get there. Like Inception, but with less handsome. So, let's talk history. Music history. Don't worry. Not gonna turn this into a series on the Peloponnesian Wars or something. Saving that for season 3. In order to understand both the musical landscape that Alice in Chains and grunge itself emerged from, and the seismic shift that their arrival would represent, I went back to take a look at the number one albums, according to the US Billboard charts, beginning 4 years before Alice in Chains would even officially form in 1987, paying particular attention to those bands that could be considered as existing in the same ballpark as hard rock or heavy metal. Because while the US charts are just one indicator of larger musical trends, I think it tells a really interesting story about where popular heavy music was coming from, and also exactly what it was that bands like Alice in Chains, Nirvana, and Soundgarden achieved. In 1983, the US charts were dominated, unsurprisingly, by Michael Jackson's Thriller, as they would continue to be in 1984. But right toward the end there, in the week of November the 26th, something interesting happens when Metal Health by Quiet Riot becomes the number one album in the United States. Exactly 1 week. A relative blip on the radar, but significant nonetheless. Metal Health is the first appearance of a heavy metal album at the very top of the US charts. The following year, order is restored to the universe as Thriller continues its legendary run, while any remaining air is sucked out of the charts with the release of Purple Rain in June. It would be another 2 years before anything even close to metal would make an appearance at the top of the US charts, unless you consider Bruce Springsteen or Heart to be hard rock slash heavy metal. Nothing against either of those artists. Heart even has a connection to Alice in Chains that we'll get to later, but for our purposes, neither of those count. Then, in 1986, Bon Jovi releases the album Slippery When Wet, which would be the first of a few number ones for the band from New Jersey. Mr. Nanavati? You're welcome. And other than 5150 by Van Halen, that was it. Because as we all know, 1986 was just not a good year for metal. Somewhere Greg from So Far So Pod just spontaneously combusted. Probably that utility closet. Gotta go check that after this. And 87 would be no different. But a year later, something starts to happen. Alice in Chains has just formed their future lineup in the year before OU812, again by Van Halen, Hysteria by Def Leppard, and New Jersey, again by Bon Jovi, would top the Billboard charts alongside an album that would eventually sell over 30 million records worldwide and become one of the most successful hard rock records of all time, behind only Back in Black by AC/DC, Led Zeppelin IV, and Metallica by Metallica. Now remember, this is where we came from. But in 1987, a band that resulted from the convergence of two popular Los Angeles club acts, Hollywood Rose and LA Guns, would release their debut album under the amalgamation of Guns N' Roses. If mental health represented where popular heavy music was coming from, Appetite for Destruction had arrived to show us just where it was headed. I would have loved to play Night Train or Mr. Brownstone or even Rocket Queen, but Welcome to the Jungle is perfect for what I'm hoping to demonstrate. Not only does it introduce the band and the album, it introduces the subgenre of sleaze rock and or metal. Most people who don't listen to either Guns N' Roses or Quiet Riot aren't going to notice the difference, mostly because no one still listens to Quiet Riot. Right? Oh, come on, don't do this to me. Don't do this to yourself. Don't do this to us. But Metal Health is basically a party rock album filled with songs like Slick Black Cadillac, Let's Go Crazy, and the one I played earlier, Come On Feel the Noise, with noise spelled N-O-I-Z-E and come spelled correctly. That record is the Citizen Kane of butt metal. It typifies what bands like Poison and Motley Crue would forever hope to achieve. Guns N' Roses definitely includes party rock elements, but the band is from LA, and they open the record with a really dark, almost dystopian critique of the city of Angels. It's basically Harvey Weinstein's inner monologue, and eventually the outer monologue of his cellmate. Oh, don't worry. Now he goes back to LA for trial, and the dude's gonna die in prison. And good for him, he really should. The first heavy metal album to reach number one in the States was about being and having ridiculous amounts of fun. It was music for banging chicks and banging heads and banging bangs. The very first metal album, however, 1970's Black Sabbath by the band Black Sabbath featuring the song Black Sabbath, was not what you would call a fun record. It was dark and brooding and heavy as fuck in all senses of the word. Remember, it was first described by music critics as downer rock? Metal Health, Slippery When Wet, 5150, OU812, Hysteria, and New Jersey did not feature any songs that would come anywhere near the kind of heavy that GNR was bringing to the number one spot with Welcome to the Jungle, Mr. Brownstone, or It's So Easy. And when I went back to listen to It's So Easy, it's been a while, but with grunge on the brain, it was the first time I realized that's a Stone Temple Pilots song. Like,
It is the blueprint. Dean DeLeo must have heard that song and said, hey, I just thought of a way to sell 40 million records. And then his brother Robert was like, okay, but I want to be a late entry into an already established scene that never really accepts us despite our sincerity and vast stores of talent. Also, our lead singer has to die from a tragic but not unsurprising drug overdose. And Dean was like, deal! But then after a minute, Robert asked with tear-rimmed eyes, so should I put these miniature replicas of early Spanish commercial whaling ships away? Are we done with that dream, Dean? Dean nodded slowly, knowing they were finally free. And now we all know why I'm not interviewing Jerry Cantrell. So, for all those who don't know the history of heavy music, the frivolous, raunchy fun of Quiet Riot had taken an unexpectedly dark and dirty turn with Guns N' Roses, but those who did know where the heavy came from would more likely recognize it as a kind of return. Don't get me wrong, Guns N' Roses was still largely fun, but literally the first time the word appears on the album is the second line of Welcome to the Jungle when Axl ironically snarls, "We've got fun and games," which sound like the kind of games that are only actually fun for one person, while the other ends up chained to a radiator and their only human interaction is every night at 3:33 a.m. exactly, when the man dressed in a $6,000 suit and a wolf mask walks in and says, "It's time for your threshing, Mr. Lazybones." Whoa, where did I go just now? I'll catch it in editing. I mean, these lines are from the album opener. Welcome to the jungle, it gets worse here every day. Learn to live like an animal in the jungle where we play. I want to watch you bleed, and I want to hear you scream. Yeah, it's replete with high-energy, fist-pumping fuck-yeahs, but if there was any doubt in the listener's mind that GNR was dragging popular heavy music back toward the downer rock from whence it came, Axl's final words would make their new musical trajectory crystal fucking clear with, "It's gonna bring you down." I mean, technically, the final word of the song is "huh," but that's not actually a word, so it doesn't count. A year later, in 1989, Appetite makes another appearance at number one, but so does Dr. Feelgood by Motley Crue, because the pendulum just keeps swinging like it's Tommy Lee's mood. And then 2 years later, after a brief national flirtation with something called MC Hammer, I don't know, she sounds lovely, GNR returns to number one with Use Your Illusion 2. Alongside Van Halen's For Unlawful Carnal Knowledge. But it was becoming very clear that in the battle for the soul of hard rock and heavy metal, the scales had tipped decidedly in the favor of the dark side. Good. As Skid Row followed GNR's lead with their heaviest and darkest record, Slave to the Grind, and of course the first of six consecutive number one records in the Black Album by Metallica. I'm just glad those first four Metallica albums never topped the Billboard charts, or people might get confused and think that those were actually the good ones. Egg on their face. Finally, we arrive at 1992 with a release of Nirvana's Nevermind. And over the course of the next 3 years, the US Billboard charts would list the following albums at number one: In Utero by Nirvana and Verses by Pearl Jam in 1993, Jar of Flies by Alice in Chains, Super Unknown by Soundgarden, Purple by STP, Vitalogy by Pearl Jam, and Nirvana again with The Unplugged in 1994. Oh, and Far Beyond Driven by Pantera, which is not a grunge album, but it is slightly less party-themed than Metal Health. And lastly, in 1995, Smashing Pumpkins would release Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness, as well as Alice in Chains' final studio album with their original lineup, the self-titled Alice in Chains. After the fall of the Soviet Union, there was this popular saying, no, the episode didn't jump forward, this is the transition I chose. So after the Soviet Union fell, there was this saying among economists and fucking dorks that went something like this: the US and Russia fought the Cold War, and Japan won. Because Japan had become this economic superpower house power in the 90s, while the two warring countries had invested so much of their capital in mutual attempts to undermine or outdo one another. So I think from looking at the US Billboard charts in the late 80s to the early 90s, we might be able to make a similar argument that thrash and glam fought the war and grunge won. And if you had grunge to USSR back to grunge on your bingo card, you just won big. And two, what kind of weird fucking bingo are you playing? With just random concepts written on ping pong balls? Why don't you just do the letter number thing? Like, What is the point? And can you put that away and try to focus on these airtight analogies that I'm dropping here? I'm spitting pearls, people. And now finally, we can return to 1987 so that I can tell you about that band like I promised 45 minutes ago. Right after a quick break. You know what, Doomy? I almost never make it to the band before the show break on the first episode. There's a lot to talk about, okay? Did you know that the DeLeo brothers made Spanish Wailing miniatures before they were in Stone Temple Pilots? No, because I made that up. You know what? We can talk about it after the break. I should probably get to Alice in Chains at some point. Oh, fuck yeah! Alice in Chains! Let's do that! When we come back.